Chapter 24. Lemuel was frantic with worry. He couldn't find Araman, and Camille was running out of time. A week that had started out so well had turned to one of the worst in the space of a couple of days. Two of his dearest friends were gravely ill, and a third was suffering at the hands of a master who used him without care for his well-being. Events were spiralling out of control. All his grand ideas for what he had hoped to learn from the Thousand Suns, as insubstantial as mist. He had learned a great deal, but what use was power when those you loved could slip away from you without warning? He had shed too many tears for lost loved ones. He wasn't going to shed any more. Camille lay in a bed not dissimilar to Callista's, though without the variety of equipment hooked up to a cranium. Cuts and grazes had been dressed, and her lungs had been flushed of carbon, ash, and trace elements of metal oxides. The wound in her side had been treated and dressed, and she had been declared physically fit and prescribed strong pain balms and 3 days of bed rest. After what Araman had told him, Lemuel worried that Camille didn't have 3 days. He had begged Colophus to find Araman, only to be told that Araman was with the Primarch and could not be disturbed. Though Lemuel's body clock was turned upside down, he guessed it was early morning. Looking at a chrono above the nurse's station, he saw that 10 hours had passed since Colophus had brought Camille in. Still, Araman had not come or even acknowledged Lemuel's calls for aid. When he returned to Camille's room, Lemuel found an attractive, ebony-skinned woman sitting by her bed, holding her hand and mopping her brow with a cloth. The elegant sweep of the woman's bone structure told Lemuel she was a native of Prospero. "Chaya?" he asked. The woman nodded and favoured him with a nervous smile.
"You must be Lemuel."
"I am," he said, rounding the bed and taking Chaya's hand. "Can we talk outside?"
Chaya glanced over at Camille. "If there is something you wish to say concerning Camille's health, I think you should tell her first, don't you?"
"Under normal circumstances, I'd agree with you," said Lemuel. "But two of my best friends have been admitted to this facility, and my usual good manners are in short supply. So please indulge me."
"It's all right, Lemuel," said Camille. "You know me. If there's news to be told, I'd rather hear it first hand. Say what you have to say."
Lemuel swallowed. Having to voice his suspicions to Camille's lover was bad enough. Admitting them to her face was almost too much to bear. "The psych new one I told you about, it turns out they lay their eggs in a rather unorthodox manner."
Camille smiled, the muscles on her face relaxing.
"It's okay," she said. "None of them stung me. Colophus kept me safe. If anything, you should be checking him out to see if he's going to become a mother."
Lemuel sat on the edge of the bed and shook his head. "That's not how they reproduce, Camille. As I said, it's rather unorthodox."
He explained what Araman had told him of the reproductive cycle of the Psychnuan, trying to emphasize that it wasn't even certain that she was in any danger. Chaya's expression told him he wasn't doing a very good job.
"You think that's what this headache is?" she asked.
"It might be," he said. "I don't know. I hope not."
"You hope not? What kind of lame answer is that?" snapped Camille. "Get me a damn brain scan or something. If I've got some aliens' eggs in my head, I bloody well want to know about it."
Lemuel nodded and said, "Of course, I'll see what I can do."
"No," said Chaya, "I'll do it. I have friends in the Thousand Suns. It will be better if I ask."
"Yes, yes," nodded Lemuel. "That sounds wise. Very well, I'll wait here, shall I?"
Chaya leaned over and gave Camille a kiss.
"I'll be back as soon as I can," she said, before heading out of the room.
Left alone with Camille, Lemuel took a seat and smiled weakly, crossing his hands on his lap.
"I'll never make a physician, will I?"
"With that bedside manner, not any time soon, no."
"How's your head, anyway?"
"Still sore."
"Oh."
"I did get a bumpy ride in Colophus's speeder. I banged my head pretty good on the seat."
"I'm sure that's it, then," said Lemuel.
"Liar."
"All right," he snapped. "So what do you want me to say? That I think alien eggs are going to hatch in your head and eat your brain while you're still alive? I'm sorry, I can't say that."
She watched him, silently. "Yeah, definitely need to work on that bedside manner," she said.
Her forced humour broke the dam within him, and he buried his head in his hands and wept, Tears flowed freely, and his chest heaved with sobs. Camille sat up.
"Hey, I'm sorry, Lemuel, but I'm the one in bed here," she said gently.
"Oh, I'm sorry," he managed eventually. "You and Callista, it's too much. I can't lose you both. I just can't."
"And you're not damn well going to," said Camille. "We'll figure this out. If there's going to be any tinkering done with my head, there's probably no better planet to be on, is there?"
Lemuel wiped his wet eyes with a sleeve and smiled.
"I suppose not. You're being very brave, you know that."
"I am on some pretty strong meds, so I wouldn't give me too much of the credit."
"You're braver than you think," said Lemuel. "That counts for a lot. Believe me, I know."
"Yeah, me and Carly are going to be fine. You wait and see," she said.
"Yes," said Lemuel bitterly. "That's all I ever do."
Camille reached out and took his hand, letting her eyes drift closed.
"No," she said. "That's not true, is it? You did all you could to save her."
Lemuel pulled his hand free.
"Don't, please."
"It's all right," said Camille. "Tell me about Malika."
He began hesitantly, for it had been many years since he had spoken of Malika. The words were too tangled in grief to come easily, but he haltingly told Camille of the brightest, most beautiful woman in the world. Her name was Malika, and they had met at a fundraising dinner held by the Lord of Sanga District to procure monies that would allow him to purchase a quarry's worth of Proconessus marble from the Anatolian Peninsula to donate to the Imperial Masonic Guild. The current guildmaster, Vadok Singh, had promised a prominent location for the statues that would be crafted from the blocks, perhaps even the Emperor's investiture, and rumour had it the commission had been awarded to no less a sculptor than Ostian Delafour. Such things took money, and the wealthier citizens of the district had been summoned to show their devotion financially. Lemuel was a rich man and had built a sizable estate, thanks to a combination of business acumen and the ability to read people's auras to know when he was being played false. He owned property throughout Mobei and was well-liked, having turned much of his wealth to philanthropic works. Malika was the daughter of the Lord of the Sanga District, and they had fallen in love that night beneath the stars and over a bottle of palm wine. They were married the following year, in a ceremony that cost more than many of the families living on Lemuel's lands made in a year. Lemuel had never been happier, and as he spoke of the first 7 years of marriage, his face lit up with golden memories. The first signs of Malika's diminishing health came with severe migraines, unexplainable blackouts, and short-term memory loss. Physicians prescribed pain balms and rest, but nothing helped alleviate her symptoms. The diagnosis of the finest medical practitioners from all across the Nordafrik districts was sought, and eventually it came to light that Malika had developed a highly aggressive astrocytoma, a malignant brain tumour that he was told was incredibly difficult to treat. Surgery alone could not control the tumour, as its cells had extended their cancer throughout her brain. Radiation therapy followed numerous surgical procedures alongside aggressive chemotherapy in an attempt to control any further tumour growth. But the physicians told Lemuel that the heterogeneous nature of her ailment was making it difficult to treat. As one cell type was destroyed, they said, others lurked in the wings to take over the job of destroying Malika's brain. Lemuel watched his wife fade away, and there was nothing he could do about it. Such helplessness was anathema to him, and he turned to ever more esoteric methods in his attempts to save her, despite the futility of their likely effect. No treatment was too ridiculous, for Lemuel was willing to try anything to save his beloved wife. Any chance was better than none. Lemuel employed homeopathic and naturopathic experts to administer holistic courses of herbal treatments, while Ayurvedic practitioners placed equal emphasis on the well-being of her mind and spirit. Qigong, acupuncture, controlled breathing, hypnosis, and orthomolecular therapies were all tried, but none of them had any effect whatsoever. Lemuel refused to give up. His researches had led him to the farthest corners of knowledge, and he uncovered many texts that spoke of forces beyond human understanding. In these books, he recognized his own abilities and read of others that could heal the sick, raise the dead, and call forth powers that were unearthly and abhorred. That didn't matter. He would do whatever it took to save his wife. She begged him to stop, but he would not listen. She had made peace with her mortality, but Lemuel could not. He wept as he told Camille of how she had watched from their roof veranda as he left on an expedition to the mountains of the Himalaya in search of hidden masters said to have achieved mastery over body and mind. If anyone could help, it would be them. Laden with all his wealth, he and his followers travelled far into the mountains and almost died in the frozen winds that scoured these highest peaks. It proved to be a wasted journey. The builders of the Emperor's palace had long since displaced any hidden masters that might once have lived in these mountains. By the time he returned to Mobei, Malika was dead.
"She was the world to me," said Lemuel as he finished his tale.
"I'm so sorry," said Camille. "I never knew. I mean, I saw something of her when I touched you on Agoru. But I didn't know. Why did you never tell us about Malika?"
Lemuel shrugged. "I don't like telling people that she died," he said. "The more people I tell, the more it sinks in that she's really gone. It makes it more real and more unchangeable somehow."
"You think you can change that she died?"
"For a while I thought I could," said Lemuel. "Some of the books I read spoke of bringing the dead back to life, but they were maddeningly vague. Nothing worked. But when the opportunity came to be selected for the Remembrancer Order, I jumped at the chance to petition the Thousand Sons."
"Why the Thousand Sons?"
"I'd heard the rumours," said Lemuel. "Hadn't you?"
"I don't listen to rumours," said Camille, smiling. "I just start them."
Lemuel chuckled. "Touché, my dear," he said. "I spent a long time listening to rumours in my search for a cure for Malika, and I'd heard a great deal spoken about the sorcery of the Thousand Sons. I heard whispers of how a great many of them had been horribly afflicted with dreadful mutations, and of how Magnus had saved his legion. I thought that if I could learn from them, I might learn how to bring Malika back."
"Oh, Lemuel," said Camille, taking his hand and kissing it. "Trust me, there's no bringing anyone back. I know. I've touched the dead, and I've listened to their lives. I've felt their love and their pain. But through all of that, I felt the joy they took in life when they were alive, the people they knew and loved. In the end, that's the best anyone can hope for, isn't it?"
"I suppose so," agreed Lemuel. "But I tried so hard."
"She knew that. Through everything, she knew you loved her and were trying to save her."
"Could I give you something of hers?" asked Lemuel. "Maybe you could read it."
"Of course. Whatever I can do, Chaya. You know that," said Camille, her voice drowsy. Lemuel frowned. "Did you just call me Chaya?"
"Sure. Why, that's your name," said Camille. "Isn't it, my love?"
Lemuel's stomach lurched as Camille's hand fell from his and her eyes widened. She gasped for air, and the entire left side of her face seemed to slip, as though invisible hands were moulding her flesh into a lopsided grimace.
"Oh, no! Camille! Camille!"
Her hands bunched into fists as they wrung the sheets on the bed, and her body stiffened with the force of the seizure. Her eyes stared with manic fury, and blood-flecked saliva drooled from the corner of her mouth. Camille's face was a mask of wordless pleading, her entire body racked with pain. Lemuel turned towards the door.
"Help! Throne of Terror! Help me, please!" he yelled.
"Can you see them?" asked Phocis Dekar.
"Yes," replied Hathor Mart. "Seeing them isn't the problem. It's doing something about it that's the problem."
"Please," begged Lemuel, "whatever you can do."
Camille's room had become a hive of activity since he'd called for help. Chaya had returned, not with medical staff or any form of imaging equipment, but with two captains of the Thousand Sons. She had introduced them as Phocis Dekar of the Second Fellowship and Hathor Mart of the Third. Evidently, she did have friends in high places. While Phocis Dekar held Camille motionless with the power of his mind, the absurdly pretty Hathor Mart placed his hands on either side of her skull. His eyes were closed, but from the motion of his pupils, it was clear he visualized with other senses.
"There are six of them, buried deep and growing fast," he said. "Ugly, white things. They're not yet larval, but it won't be long before they pupate."
"Can you save her?" asked Chaya, her voice as brittle as cracked crystal.
"What do you think we're trying to do?" snapped Fosset to Carr.
"They're cunning, little bastards!" hissed Hathor Mart, twisting his head and moving his hands around Camille's skull. "Organic tendrils, like anchors, are burrowing into the meat of the brain, tethering themselves to the nerve fibres. I need to burn them out, slowly."
"Burn them out?" asked Lemuel, horrified at the idea.
"Of course," said Mart. "How else did you think I was going to do it? Now, be quiet."
Lemuel held on to Chaya's hand and she to his. Though they had not met before today, they were united in their love for Camille. From the straining muscles in her neck and arms, Lemuel could tell that Camille's body was trying to thrash out its agony on the bed, but Fosis Takar kept her immobile without apparent effort.
"I see you," said Hathor Mart, curling his finger as though hooking a fish. Lemuel smelled the sickly aroma of something burning.
"You're hurting her," he cried. "I told you to be quiet," barked Hathor Mart. "The tiniest fraction of a misstep, and I may end up burning out the mechanism that allows her to breathe or pumps blood from her heart. I have its body, and am slowly boiling it alive." He laughed with relish.
"Oh, you don't like that, do you?" he said. "Trying to dig your hooks in deeper, eh? Well, let's see about that."
Hathor Mart dug his fingers downwards, spreading the tips wide and smiling as the smell of burning meat grew stronger. He worked within Camille's skull for over an hour before nodding to himself.
"One, two, three, and four. Got them," he said.
"You got them all?" asked Lemuel.
"Don't be foolish. That was just the tendrils of the first egg. They're tenacious and aren't going without a fight. It's loose now, but we need to get it out fast before it reattaches. Fosset Takar."
"Got it," said the captain of the Second Fellowship.
Fosset Takar placed his hand inside Camille's ear and twisted his extended fingers as though attempting to pick the most complex of locks. His fingers were incredibly dexterous, and Lemuel held his breath as Fosset Takar gradually drew his fingers back towards his palm.
"Incosazana preserve us," cried Lemuel,
as something wet and wriggling emerged from Camille's ear. It looked like a spine slug, and its slimy body writhed as it was drawn forth by Fosis Takar's incredibly precise power. The slug-like creature plopped down into a gleaming kidney bowl, leaving a sticky trail of blood and slime behind it. Just looking at it made Lemuel feel sick.
"Would you like to do the honours?" asked Fosis Takar, handing Lemuel the kidney bowl with a grin.
"Oh, absolutely," replied Lemuel.
He tipped the bowl and dropped the pre-larval psychnuin to the tiled floor of the Medicae Bay. He stamped on it and ground it to a gooey paste with his heel.
"One down, five to go," said Hathor Mart, his skin streaked in sweat. "Just as well I'll have a challenge."
Beyond the pyramid of apothecaries, a light rain fell over Tisca. Rain was uncommon over the city, and its inhabitants came out into the streets to feel it on their skin. Children played in the rain, and the streets echoed with squeals of delight as they splashed in puddles and stood beneath spouting gutters. It continued for days, drowning the city every morning. No one knew where it came from, for the techno-psychic arrays built into the mountains were normally an entirely reliable means of predicting and controlling the planet's climate. Some rain was, of course, necessary to keep the ecosystem in balance, but this was beyond anything the inhabitants of Tisca had ever experienced. The buildings glistened with rainwater, and the streets flowed with gurgling rivers. Questions were asked of the Thousand Suns, but no answer was forthcoming as to the cause of the unseasonable rains. Fully half the Legion's captains were in absentia, and those who remained had no answer. On the sixth day, an impromptu parade was held through Oculum Square, where the crowd threw off its clothes and cavorted naked in the rain. Tisca had no standing force of enforcers, so elements of the Prospero Spire Guard were deployed to return their deliriously naked dancers to their abodes. The seventh day saw several members of the parade fall ill with a deadly form of viral pneumonia, and the following morning riots broke out in front of the Pyramid of Apothecaries as frightened people demanded a vaccine. 63 people died before the Spire Guard restored order, and a sullen mood fell upon the city. On the ninth day, the rains finally ceased, and the sun broke through the dark clouds that hung like disapproving judges over the heart of the city. A luminous beam of light shone down on Tisca, bathing it in golden radiance and striking the flaming urn atop the great column at the centre of Oculum Square. Mahavishnu Kalamakas wrote that it was like the light of heaven returning to Prospero. Deep within the reflecting caves, that light returned to its source. Magnus opened his eye, and the athame withdrew from his flesh, its blade crumbling to dust as soon as it came into contact with the air. Adaman let out a relieved sigh as Magnus sat up, swinging his legs over the side of the white slab and blinking furiously in the darkness. Only the dim glow that swam in the walls illuminated the chamber. Of the 1,000 thralls, only 18 remained alive. Though their bodies were gaunt and drained, the glow from their crystals faint and almost extinguished. "My lord," said Amon, coming forward with a goblet of water, "it is good to see you." Magnus nodded, and Adaman saw how pale his skin had become. His long, red hair was matted with sweat, and Adaman thought he could see the writhing veins and pulsing organs beneath the Primarch's skin. And that was a lie, for Adaman had seen into the heart of Magnus, and there was nothing so mundane as liver, lungs, or kidney within that immortal frame. Fael Torren, Uthisar, and Oromagma crowded in, their joy at seeing Magnus return beyond measure. Only Adaman held back, his emotions mixed at what they had done. For 9 long days they stood vigil over their beloved Primarch, neither eating, nor sleeping, nor partaking of food and water. No words had passed between them, and no communication had been attempted with their brothers on the surface. "Was it worth it?" asked Adaman. "Did you succeed?" Magnus fixed him with his single eye, a dull orb of watery blue, and shook his head slowly. "No, Azek, I think that I did not," said Magnus. "Just as I attempted to save my brother from the abyss, others were ready to push him in." "Others?" snarled Oromagma. "Who?" "A wretch named Erebus, who serves my erstwhile brother Lorgar. It seems the powers that seek to ensnare Horus Lupercal have already claimed some pieces on this board. The word-bearers are already enthralled to chaos."
"Lorgar's legion have betrayed us also?" asked Fael Torren. "This treachery runs deeper than we could ever have imagined."
"Chaos," said Adaman. "You use the term as if it were a name."
"It is, my son," said Magnus. "It is the primordial annihilator that has hidden in the blackest depths of the great ocean since the dawn of time, but which now moves with infinite patience to the surface. It is the enemy against which all must unite, or the human race will be destroyed. The coming war is its means of achieving the end of all things."
"Primordial annihilator? I have never heard of such a thing," said Adaman.
"Nor had I until I faced Horus and Erebus," said Magnus.
And Adaman was shocked to see the barest flicker in his Primarch's aura. Magnus was lying to them. He had known of this primordial annihilator.
"So what do we do now?" asked Uthisar. "Surely now we must warn the Emperor."
Magnus hesitated before nodding slowly.
"Yes, we must," he said. "If my father is forewarned, he can take arms against Horus before it is too late."
"Why will he believe us?" asked Adaman. "We have no proof."
"I have the proof now," sighed Magnus wearily. "Now, return to your cult temples and await my summons. Amon, attend upon me. The rest of you may leave."
The captains of fellowship turned and made their way towards the crystal steps that led out of the cave.
"Adaman," said Magnus, "bend all the power of the Corvidae to unravelling the strands of the future. We must know more of what is to come. Do you understand me?"
"I do, my lord," replied Adaman.
"Do whatever it takes," said Magnus, "whatever the cost may be."
Lemuel awoke to find Adaman standing over him. His mentor had a stern look in his eye, and Lemuel immediately felt the tension in the room. He stifled a yawn, realizing he'd fallen asleep next to Callista's bed once again. Her eyes were closed, though it was hard to tell whether it was in sleep or unconsciousness. Camille sat across from him, her breathing still that of a sleeper. Camille had recovered well from her ordeal with the Psychnew and eggs, quickly returning to her normal, vivacious self.
"My lord," he said, "what is it?"
Amon and Anquinen stood behind Adaman, making the room feel suddenly small.
"You should leave, both of you," Adaman told him.
"Leave? Why?"
"Because you will find what has to happen here unpleasant."
"I don't understand," he said, rising from his chair and moving protectively towards Callista.
Camille woke and looked up, startled as she saw Astartes filling the room. "Lem?" she asked, immediately picking up on the tension. "What's going on?"
"I don't know yet," he said.
"I do not expect you to understand," said Adaman, with real regret in his voice, "but events are in motion that require us to know of the future. Our normal methods of gathering such information are denied to us, so we must seek other avenues."
"What are you going to do? I won't let you hurt her."
"I am sorry, Lemuel," said Adaman. "We have no choice. This has to happen. Believe me, I wish it did not."
Amon moved towards the bank of walnut-panelled machines and turned all the dials to their middle positions. The light began to fade from the crackling, buzzing globes, and the needles on the brass readouts nosed their way down.
"What is he doing?" Camille wanted to know. "Lord Adaman, please!"
Adaman said nothing, his face betraying his unease.
"You wanted to know what this machine was for," said Ankuinen, taking Lemuel's arm.
The giant Astartes easily pulled him away from Callista's side and handed him off to Adaman.
"It's an etheric blocker. It isolates the subject's mind from the great ocean. We used such devices to subdue our brothers when the flesh change came upon them. It was the only way to stop it. Your friend's mind is locked open to its roaring tides, and but for these devices, etheric energy would be pouring into her."
"Can you shut her mind to it?" asked Camille, standing protectively beside her friend.
The Astartes said nothing, and Lemuel read the truth in their auras.
"They can," he said, "but they won't."
"She should be dead already," hissed Ankuinen, dragging Camille out of the way. "She has a unique link to future currents, and we must make use of all the tools available to us."
"Tools? Is that all we've been to you?" asked Lemuel, struggling uselessly in Adaman's grip. "All this time, were you just using us?"
"It was not like that," said Adaman, casting a poisonous glance at Ankuinen.
"Yes, it was," said Lemuel. "I see that now. You think you're so clever, but you're blinded by your belief in the superiority of your knowledge. You can't even contemplate that someone else might know better than you."
"Because no one else does," snapped Adaman. "We do know better than anyone else."
"Maybe you do, but maybe you don't. What if there's something you're missing? What if there's some little piece of the puzzle you don't know about?" "Be silent," ordered Ankuinen. "We are the architects of fate, not you."
"So what happens when you turn those machines off?" asked Camille, taking Lemuel's hand as they realized the futility of resisting the Astartes physically.
"We will listen to what she has to say, and we will learn of the future."
"No, I won't let you," said Lemuel.
"No?" sneered Ankuinen.
"Who are you to bark orders at us, little man? You think because Araman has taught you a few parlour tricks that you are one of us? You are mortals. Your abilities and intellect are beneath our notice."
"Araman, please," begged Lemuel. "Don't do this."
"I'm sorry, Lemuel, but they are right. Callista is dying anyway. At least this way her death will mean something."
"That's a lie," shouted Lemuel. "If you do this, you'll be killing her. You might as well put a bullet in her brain and be honest about it."
Amon removed some of the contact points on Callista's skull and consulted the readouts on the etheric blocker. He nodded to Ankuinen and said,
"It is done. I have kept some of the blocks in place, but her mind is open to the ether now. Just a fraction, but it should be enough to generate divinatory activity."
Callista's eyes fluttered open, and she drew in a panicked breath as awareness was forced back to the surface of her consciousness. Her lips moved, and breaths of hoarse air gusted from somewhere deep inside her. The temperature in the room fell sharply.
"A million shards of glass, a million times a million, all broken, all shattered glass. The eye in the glass, it sees and it knows, but it does nothing."
Her eyes drifted shut, and her breathing deepened. No more words were forthcoming, and Ankuinen leaned over her, prizing the lids of her eyes open.
"Increase the flow of etheric energy," he ordered. "We can get more out of her."
"Please," begged Camille, "don't do this."
"Araman, she's an innocent. She doesn't deserve this," cried Lemuel.
The Thousand Suns ignored them, and Amon again adjusted the dials on the machine. The needles dipped even farther, and Callista's body jerked on the bed, her legs kicking the covers from her feet. Lemuel didn't want to watch, but couldn't tear his eyes from the dreadful sight.
She screamed, and the words poured from her in a flood as the temperature continued to plummet.
"It's too late! The wolf is at the door, and it hungers for blood! Oh, throne, no, the blood! The ravens, I see them too, the lost sons and a raven of blood. They cry out for salvation and knowledge, but it is denied. A brother betrayed, a brother murdered. The worst mistake, for the noblest reason. It cannot happen, but it must."
Sweat poured from Callista's face. Her eyes bulged in their sockets, and every muscle and sinew of her body stretched to breaking point. The effort of speaking was too much, and she fell back, her frame racked with agonizing convulsions. Lemuel felt Adaman's grip slacken, and he looked up to see regret written across his face. He extended his aura, projecting his disgust and sadness at Callista's treatment by the Thousand Sons into Adaman's. The effect was subtle, but Adaman looked down at him with an expression that was part admiration and part remorse. "That will not work on me," said Adaman. "You have learned much, but you don't have the strength to influence me with the little power you have."
"Then you're just going to let this happen?"
"I have no choice," said Adaman. "The Primarch has demanded it to be so."
"Lem, they're going to kill her," pleaded Camille.
Adaman turned to face her, saying, "She is already dead, Mistress Shivani." He nodded to Amon. "Allow the ether free rein within her. We must know everything." Magnus's equerry turned back to the machine and turned all the dials to zero. The needles fell slack and the lights winking on its surface extinguished. The glass readouts on the machine cracked with frost and the globes misted over. Lemuel felt cold, like the chill at the end of the world. The effect on Callista was instantaneous. Her back arched and her eyes snapped open. Blazing light streamed out like the furnace breath of an incinerator. It illuminated the room with a sickly blue-green light, throwing shadows of things that didn't exist across every wall. The ghostly howls of a million monsters ripped from her throat, and Lemuel smelled the awful stench of roasted human flesh. Smoke poured from Callista's body, and even the Astartes were horrified at what was happening to her. The flesh bubbled and smoked on her bones, peeling away in blackened flakes as though the target of an invisible flamethrower. Her body hissed and spat as it was reduced to jellied runnels of boiling fat and meat. Yet through it all, she still screamed. Long after her heart and lungs and brain were blackened husks, she kept screaming. The sound cut through Lemuel like a hot knife, twisting in his guts with treacherous force. He dropped to his knees as a screeching whine like a host of fingernails dragged down a slate board bit into his head. Camille was screaming, her grip on his hand as powerful as a clamping vice. Then, with a terrible, ripping, tearing sound, it was over. Lemuel blinked away bright sunbursts, feeling his stomach lurch at the stench of burnt meat that hung like a miasma in the air. He pulled himself to his feet, dreading what he would see as much as he needed to see what had become of Callista Eris. Nothing remained of the beautiful remembrancer, save a blackened outline seared into the sheets, and smoking pools of rendered flesh that drooled from the bed in long, rubbery ropes.
"What did you do?"
he whispered, tears streaming down his face.
"Oh, Callista, you poor, poor girl."
"We did what we needed to," hissed Anku Anen. "I make no apologies."
"No," said Lemuel, turning to help Camille to her feet. "You didn't need to do this. This was murder, plain and simple."
Camille wept with him, burying her head in his shoulder and clawing at his back with heaving sobs of grief. Adaman reached out to him.
"I am truly sorry, my friend," he said.
Lemuel shrugged off his hand, moving past Adaman towards the door with his arms wrapped tightly around Camille.
"Don't touch me," he said. "We are no longer friends. I don't know if we ever were."